Show. I'm Michael Hogue, your host. Glad to have you with us here on this Monday morning here in the city as you listen to the Arts Magazine Show right here on KKFI 90.1 FM, your community radio station, right here in Kansas City. A start of a new year. All new plays, a whole new season of plays from various theaters around the area. If you want to be on the show at some point in this year, you need to contact us here at the radio station. Give me a lot of leeway, at least a month. That's what we need to do this. But we'll find out. We'll find a good spot for you and make it worth your while as well. With us on the show today, we're going to talk to, one of the guests we had here last week. She was brave enough to come back. And this actually happened with her once before. One other time in the storied history of this program, she was back-to-back guest from 1 week to the other, and that has happened again, so that's probably a new record. Nancy Eppert is with us. Hello, once again.
Hi, thank you.
You were brave enough to come back again.
I found my way. There was no snow, and so I'm ready to go.
Okay. I hope there's no snow out there for you. She is directing Last Night of the Ballyhoo. It's a production of the City Theater of Independence. It will open on, it's getting very close now, Nancy, January the 8th on Thursday evening, with performances continuing on the 9th. And a big Saturday performance with a dinner theater as well on Saturday the 10th.
That's
then
right.
Performances continue the 16th, 17th in the evening, and Sunday afternoon the 18th, a 2 o'clock afternoon matinee performance at the City Theater of Independence, located at 201 North Dodgen Street, essentially the corner of Truman and Nolan Roads in Independence. Welcome once again to the program.
You
direct all over town, so when you pick a show to direct, there must be a special meaning here for you.
Absolutely. I've really enjoyed this play. I saw it, I think, first a portion of it in competition with the American Association of Community Theater, which I serve as an adjudicator. And I saw a snippet of it, but because I'm adjudicating, I have to read the entire play. And I thought, my goodness, this is such a great story. There are so many nuances. There are so many levels that I just really wanted to get this show mounted. So I brought it to the season selection committee for the City Theater, and they selected it. And then I interviewed to direct it, and I was awarded that directorialship. So I'm excited to get this one mounted, and I've got a brilliant cast. I keep pinching myself over and over because they really are exceptional actors and actresses on this stage.
Yeah, it's an interesting play. Last Night of the Ballyhoo takes place in the time when Gone with the Wind was about to have its Atlanta premiere, and it was big in Atlanta because, after all, they burned Atlanta during the course of the show. And the opening was a big thing. I mean, Clark Gable was there. All the actors in the show were there. Very big thing for Atlanta at the time.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And the Last Night of Ballyhoo being a huge cotillion for the Jewish population. And we meet the Freitag family. It's interesting because they are a very wealthy Jewish family, have lived in the Atlanta area for quite some time. But we find they're not exactly kosher, if you will. They've not been practicing for a while. And the head of the family, Adolf, or Adolf, as the cast keeps calling him, which is fine, he has hired a young man from Brooklyn, New York, who's very devout. And so the sparks fly and the romances begin. And it's quite an intriguing interrelationship and sort of a searching type of thing. You find a lot of things about some of the characters that you're not quite ready to find out.
Yeah, this was, of course, around 1939, mm-hmm. somewhere in that area. The Second World War was not really underway yet. This was a Jewish family, actually a German Jewish family, in the Deep South, in Atlanta, Georgia.
Exactly.
Political, social problems there?
A lot. And it's interesting because even political within the Jewish culture, because we find out that there's a huge difference between German Jewish and other Jewish. So we call them the others, which is an interesting thing because you don't think about some of these nuances that were taking place. And the author, this was actually written as part of a trilogy for the Atlanta Olympics. And one of the other plays that Mr. Urey is famous for, Alfred Urey, is Driving Miss Daisy. And it's very interesting because he also wrote some of the episodes for Designing Women. So you see a lot of this wonderful Southern culture in all these wonderful characters. We have one of our actors here and one of our actresses, and they're very seasoned and adept at bringing these characters to life. And so with these wonderful words that have been written, they have done a fabulous interpretation.
Yeah, Melissa Anderson is with us. She plays the role of Lala in the show. How does your character fit into this this large scheme of goings on, the tradition as opposed to the current events at the time?
Well, Lala is the daughter to Boo Levy. She is so much fun. She is obsessed with Gone with the Wind.
Ah.
It is her thing. She wants to be there for every part of it. She wants to look the part, smell the part, just eat the part up. She wants to live Scarlett O'Hara.
Does she realize what a hard life Scarlett O'Hara has? Maybe not at the beginning of the movie, but certainly towards the end.
Certainly towards the end. And that is something that Lala has not lived, is a hard life. I call her my pretty, pretty princess character. She's kind of been privileged and spoiled. And so, yeah.
Hence the term Jewish princess we hear bandied about?
Yeah, maybe a little bit.
A lot.
Yeah. Basically, everything that she wants, she gets.
Does she feel, or does she even realize, what's going on around her as opposed to the way her life is?
No, Lala lives in her own little Lala bubble. It's very true. Yeah. She doesn't get to be the serious one, and she doesn't let the social stuff that's going on around her really affect her. She gets to live in her own little Gone with the Wind bubble.
She doesn't do well with competition.
She does not do well with competition because she's always got whatever she wanted.
Interesting. Does this make it difficult for Patrick Lee Davis is with us as well. He plays the role of Joe. Do you have a relationship with Lala?
Oh, how does one answer that question in as few words as we have time for? The answer to that is yes. Joe really comes into town with no knowledge of really how this family works. He just is a worker. He works for Adolf. Let's try to start saying it differently now, since he's pointed it out on air. Everyone knows. He works for Adolf, and he comes into the house, and he and Lala kind of start to have a brief flirtation, but that doesn't last very long. And as the story goes on, you do kind of live in your own Lala bubble,
I
just kind of disappear off the radar at a certain point. But no, Joe ends up having a romance with another one of the characters, Sunny. Who is Reba's daughter, and I know we haven't really gotten to that character yet. I'm jumping ahead.
It's Lala's cousin.
Lala's cousin, yeah. Did I say sister?
It's all right.
Close enough.
Right.
It sounds complicated enough as it is, Patrick.
It's the South. Who knows? But no, he has Joe ends up having a relationship with Sonny. But when it comes to Lala, Joe is very taken aback by the fact that this family seems very detached from the Jewish roots that Joe knows and loves. There actually is a brief conversation that Lala and I have about Pesach, which is Passover. And to this family, that's we went and did that once or twice. Like, it was a weekend kind of thing. But to Joe, it's a way of life. So it kind of throws him off that this family doesn't seem, they are Jewish and they claim to be Jewish, yet at the same time, they're not following the faith as he knows it, so it really does confuse him.
Not everyone does. Not even in Israel, where I visited last spring. They don't follow the traditions. Not all of them do. Some do, some do
right.
not. And as our interpreter and guide told us, there's no such thing as a bad Jew. You either follow it or you don't, but both are accepted.
Yeah, and I think really that's one of Joe's points in the show, is his faith and understanding that whereas you do not want to compromise your faith, sometimes in our faith and in how we react with other people, we do have to compromise on how staunchly we are going to lay down the law and the line on that.
It's difficult.
One of the themes that during this play that I think is really interesting is that the author, Yuri, has put into a lot of prejudice, personal inadequacies, and different characters. We find how they cope with a lot of these nuances. One of the things that I find actually fascinating about this play is that how we when we deal with our own, what we perceive as our personal inadequacies or our prejudices, we immediately point them out in others. And that is something that in this play, in this group of characters, they're always looking for faults in others and in themselves because of that, that underlying fear of inadequacy. It's a very potent scene between Melissa's character, Lala, and Jackie Coombs' character, Sonny, who are the cousins. She points out, Lala's pointing out how unfair God has been to her. That, you know, look at me, the way I talk, the way I look, and so forth. But it's very interesting because something I was looking for, and I don't even know if they're aware, something I was looking for in the actresses is their similarities. Because they really do, even though there's a height difference, their skin tones, their hair tones, just the way they look, when they stand literally eye to eye looking at each other, their noses have the same sort of curve to them. And I know the actresses weren't aware of this, but I needed to look for something similar because that scene is so powerful. And it's just so unfounded when you look at how we perceive ourselves and how these characters perceive themselves, that when the speech is over, you look at the two women going, but you're the same. You've just chosen to react differently to what God has dealt to you.
Yeah, difficult decisions to make sometimes. But in their situation, are they in some ways cocooned from the events that are going on in the world, the things that are to come?
Definitely Lala is. Yeah, she keeps, I think Boo, her mother, keeps her very sheltered and, you know, basically is, I think almost Boo is almost living out her childhood with Lala and what she wanted it to be. So there's a lot of parental pressure with Lala, less societal.
Is it that way with her friends as well, do you think?
Does Lala have friends?
Oh, well, okay.
Yeah, no, Lala, yeah, of course.
How does this affect the character of Joe, Brad, or Patrick?
Again, a good question.
Not always. We don't always have good stuff. Sometimes we do.
I would say, and please, Nancy, correct me if I'm wrong on this, that it affects him.
Oh, I will.
Yeah, he's like, I'm waiting. I've got the answer sheet right here. I think it affects Joe in the sense that Jackie Coombs' character, Sonny, is very independent, and she's very free-thinking as well. And so in this side of things, Joe really is kind of stuck in this. Without trying to be prejudiced, he's being prejudiced himself. And that really shows up in some of the final scenes of the show. And actually, that's really kind of where that kind of dead ends, to be quite honest. Hopefully that answers the question.
Of course it does.
It's very curious because one of the first introductions that Joe has to this family is that he walks into their very interesting home where Lala has been decorating a Christmas tree. And make such a big deal about it.
But she's Jewish.
I know. Isn't that amazing? They really have tried over the generations, and it's more than just the generation that Lala and Joe and Sonny come from, but it's the parents as well. They've lost probably a couple generations back trying to assimilate into this Southern society. And it's also fascinating, just sort of a little side note on the set that you will see. You walk in and you see this thing that looks very Mexican, very Cuban, if you will, or Southwestern. And there's a reason for that. The author specifically talks about this type of design for the set in his work, and it's, you go back and you look at the history of this in the 1920s and 30s when our country was going through prohibition and a lot of gambling, a lot of things that were not allowed to go on in this country. The rich and famous were going south of the border, going to Mexico, going to Cuba, and to gamble, to drink, to carouse, to do all these wonderful things, and they started bringing that influence back into their homes. It's fascinating to find out that Lucy and Desi Arnaz, Bing Crosby were co-owners in a racetrack in Mexico. He was very much into the racetrack. And then Desi Arnaz, being Cuban, they were some of the first ones to have that Mexican or that Southwestern or that modified Southwestern look in their homes. And that influence came into our country through that influence. So I guess they're down south carousing, and they want to bring it back home with them and just kind of live that life for a while. So there's a lot of little nuances that you don't quite understand at the surface, but that's the way these characters are, too. You don't quite understand them just at the surface.
When I think of Atlanta in the late 1930s, I don't think as broadly as that. Is that why the playwright, and you said that this was in preparation for the Olympics in Atlanta?
Right. This was actually written for the Atlanta Olympics. And originally, every one of the characters were done in vignettes. There were individual standalone characters, but there was such an interest that Alfred Urey put this into a scripted play. And it ran for a long time in New York. It was a huge success when it was actually mounted there, and it ran for several seasons. Then it broadened out into a lot of regional theater and then to the community theater. But it was written specifically for that Olympic because, again, celebrating Gone with the Wind. Again, it looks at this Jewish family or a family that's just not, they've lost track of themselves. Mm-hmm. And what was really important, and you don't know until somebody comes in and points out, like, you've really misunderstood. But yet, it's interesting because here's Lala's character, and her whole life now is centered around this huge ballyhoo, which is a huge gathering of Jewish youth, if you will, from, you know, the young adults throughout the South. And they even have a disagreement of where it actually started, between the mothers. They're not even sure how it all started.
Well, how the ballyhoo started.
Exactly. Somebody else started it because of this and this and this. And so these two Jewish women sit there and they have this interesting discussion.
Is that one of the things that was important then? Probably not as important as their bar mitzvah was.
Well, and they talk about some things that's interesting in the bat and bar mitzvah for the coming of adulthood for the girls and boys. They also talk about something about confirmation, and this is also something that was a reformation, if you will, through the Jewish culture. And I myself am not Jewish, and so I've talked with several people that are, and I have some good resource people that I go to and ask specifically when I do a cultural play. And the confirmation actually was less formal, more party, more social. It was based around the didacticness of the Jewish culture, but it turned in more of a, if you will, it was like any other confirmation, and then a graduation party and those type of things. So it was a little more relaxed than the bar and bat mitzvahs.
Was that a thing that was exclusive to the South, or
no?
They had cotillions all over the country.
This cotillion. I'm not sure exactly about that. The confirmations, yes, and it started in the early 1800s. But the ballyhoo, I think, is about the conventions and things that the Jewish youth have. But because Joe even mentions that is this a convention? And they go, oh, no name tags, no lectures, none of this.
No business meetings.
No business meetings. It's probably all about matchmaking. So if there's a yenta around somewhere, it's all about matchmaking.
Oh, interesting. Was that the idea behind the mothers? They're wanting to match up, perhaps, Lala and Joe? I see.
Boo is just against me, period.
You're not a... Boo is not a fan of you. Sorry. No, Lala is being pretty much forced to go out with this gentleman named Peachy, who is a member of the finest family in the South. So her mother is arranging this little meeting and dance partner for Lala.
I see.
Yes.
Do you have any feelings about this?
Joe is... I really feel that Joe is honestly the poor dumb kid who was in the right place at the wrong time or the wrong place at the right time.
I felt that way myself.
Depending on how you want to look at the show. But no, he actually spends most of the show confused about how ballyhoo and all this stuff works. And it's very much... Joe's character is very much the fish out of water. And he's desperately trying to find any source of liquid anywhere because he's kind of drowning in this... He's drowning in this confusion of how are these people working this? How does this work? I don't get it. I'm from Eastern Parkway. You know, I'm from New York. What's going on? And it's honestly how he spends most of the show, is really confused about this family.
Sure. You're very good with the metaphors. How much acting experience do you have?
I started acting when I was 5.
Wow.
My parents were working at the Kansas City Meistersingers Community Opera, which sadly no longer exists.
I know. That's unfortunate. I had them on under a different name. I think the Civic Opera.
Yeah, I think
they were called in later years.
Yeah. But I started doing shows at Blue Springs. And then, actually, one of the first shows I wasn't originally in the show was Nancy's Fiddler on the Roof that my mom was in, and my father was a firefighter. I didn't have a babysitter, so I just kind of sat in the stalls. And one day, Nancy was like, "Wait, what are you doing?" "I'm just sitting here. Get up on stage." "Okay." So that kind of stuff. Yeah, you just, here, wear this. Oh, all right.
That actually happened to me as a kid, too. And who knows where that could lead.
Exactly. You have no idea. You know, 20 years from now, you're Al Pacino going, "How did I get here?"
Yeah, that's right.
I'm confused.
That's right.
But no, just summing up on that, Joe's whole fish out of water experience kind of changes him, and he starts to get a little bit more angry about it as he's put into situations with these people, and Peachy included. Peachy and I do not get along, as you'll definitely see in the show. Spoiler alert, but give away the whole story. But no, Joe really sees this ballyhoo thing as just, it's to him, I think it's just another dance to go with a pretty girl, and he doesn't realize the significance it's going to have not only on his life, but how the rest of his belief system is going to continue from this day forward.
Oh, sure. What about Melissa? Where have we seen you on the stage
where
before?
Have you seen me?
I get around.
Yeah, I've been around. Not in that way. There you go. So
I see a lot of shows.
I studied musical theater at the American Musical Dramatic Academy in New York City and moved back here and got married and have been doing community theater since then. I've done quite a few shows at City Theater and then out at the Barn as well.
What shows at the Barn have we seen?
Barn. Full Monty. I was,
oh, well, that was
Sarah Dina
in
9, so yeah. I had that lovely tambourine dance, which was a lot of fun. It's probably one of my favorite moments on stage is that.
Did you feel overmatched in Full Monty? I mean, all the attention was not on you.
Yeah, no, you don't need us there. It's just all about the guys.
That's right.
They were so much fun. That was such a great show to be involved in.
Are you more comfortable with musicals or straight plays?
I love straight plays because I love to just immerse myself into like individual scenes and one-on-one scenes where, you know, it's a nice break from the jazz hands.
Well, sure.
So, but I do enjoy a good musical. It's probably what I do the most. Straight plays, I did Miss Firecracker with City Theater last year and played Carnell. And before that, I've done Noises Off with Nancy.
I was actually on stage with her. With
yeah.
That. We were acting together.
Oh, you were one of those people going up and down stairs and slamming doors.
I was the one character that never had to go up the steps.
I know. I can't tell you how many times I went up the steps in heels and a skirt. But we were also together. Actually, Melissa and I were together also in Midsummer Night's Dream.
Midsummer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Get up here, Tom.
I know. I'm talking in the background.
So do you want to talk to Bree? We only have a few minutes left. Any of the other performers in the show? Nancy?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Yes, we do have other performers in the show.
It's not really?
It's not a two-person show. Yeah,
we love them.
Are you not aware there are other people on stage with you?
I thought I was going insane.
Right. The patriarch of the home is played by Jack McCord. Then we also
Jack's
have...
Jack's always good.
Yes. I mean, like I said, this is like two things checked off my personal theater bucket list. A great play with great actors. I've done other shows, great shows that I loved with great actors. But this one in my own hometown, this is kind of, for me, a bucket list thing. We have the two matriarchs of the family. We have Patty Shockley playing Reba. And we have Stephanie Flanagan, who you've seen recently in the Dixie Swim Club in Blue Springs. She's also playing Boo, who plays Melissa's mother. We also have the other ingenue character, if you will, Jackie Coombs, who plays Sonny, and the other male interest is Peachy, played by Alex Phillips. And so it's interesting, but we found out that Melissa, Jackie, myself, Patty, and Stephanie all have a common history. We were all in Midsummer Night's Dream years ago, and we've sort of gone different ways at different times, and it's really kind of fun to bring this family together, this wonderful group of actors, as well as the wonderful technicians that we have, our set designer and builders, and our properties and lights and sound. I mean, it's a wonderful working team, and I'm just thrilled to do it again in my own hometown.
Sure. Last night of the Ballyhoo.
It's last night of Ballyhoo. I'll help you out there, Michael, just a little bit.
Last night of Ballyhoo opens up on January the 8th on Thursday at 8 o'clock p.m. Performances continue on Friday the 9th. Also at 8, a big dinner fundraiser on Saturday the 6th. They usually do that for every opening weekend.
Every first Saturday, and it's opening Saturday night, is a dinner theater catered by Nadler's out of Lexington, Missouri. And wonderful, I got to tell you, they got the best desserts out there. Their other food is wonderful. But then we continue for that following weekend. And so, yes, it is a fundraiser, that first.
Okay, and performances then continue the next week, Friday the 16th and Saturday the 17th, both at 8 o'clock. And it ends on Sunday the 18th with a 2 o'clock afternoon matinee at City Theater of Independence, the Powerhouse Theater, because it used to be a powerhouse. 201 North Dodgen, that's essentially the corners of Truman Road and Nolan Road in Independence, Missouri. The number to call for more information, 816-325-7367, or online. You can make your arrangements at citytheaterofindependence.org. I want to thank my guests. Three really good ones today. Nancy Eppert, the director, last night of Ballyhoo at City Theater. Melissa Anderson, who plays the role of Lala. And Patrick Lee Davis, who plays the role of Joe in Last Night of Ballyhoo, opening this Thursday the 8th. Much more for you right here on the Arts Magazine Show, right here on KKFI, 90.1 FM.
Hi, I'm Russ Simmons with Freeze Frame, KKFI's weekly look at the newest cinematic fare at your local theaters. As we begin the new year, it's time to take a look back at my picks for the best films of 2014. At number 10, Force Majeure. A family survives an avalanche while on a ski vacation, but the experience strains their relationships in this thought-provoking French entry. Number 9, Leviathan. While very depressing, the tale of corruption in modern Russia is an intriguing reworking of the story of Job. Number 8, Snowpiercer. The best movie nobody saw this year, a wildly imaginative sci-fi adventure. It's an arty sociological satire masquerading as an action flick. At number 7, The Imitation Game. Benedict Cumberbatch stars as Alan Turing, a scientist who helped break the Nazi Enigma code. It's a beautifully written and engaging drama. Number 6, Locke. Tom Hardy gives a riveting performance in what amounts to a one-man show. This unique and compelling drama is more than just a cinematic gimmick. At number 5, Boyhood. Filmed over a 12-year period, Richard Linklater's coming-of-age story highlights family life in all its dysfunctional glory. Number 4, Whiplash. Miles Teller and J.K. Simmons give snappy performances in the story of a jazz drum student and his abusive professor. It's brilliantly edited. At number 3, Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. Yes, I'm surprised it made my list, too. It's both an intelligent and thoughtful sci-fi social commentary, as well as a thrilling popcorn movie. At number 2, Gone Girl. Salacious, yes. Lurid, you bet. Far-fetched, absolutely. Gone Girl is all of those things, and this adaptation of Kansas City native Gillian Flynn's novel is also one of the best and most entertaining movies of the year. And at number 1, Birdman. The fantastical story of a washed-up actor, a former movie superhero, attempting a comeback on Broadway is easy to dislike. Still, it's a tour de force of acting, writing, and directing. It's funny, profane, and arty to a fault, but there's no denying Birdman soars. Well, that's it for this edition of Freeze Frame. Until next time, I'm Russ Simmons with Fox 4 and KKFI-FM. Freeze Frame!
And welcome back to the Arts Magazine Show right here on KKFI 90.1 FM, your community radio station right here in Kansas City. I'm Michael Hoag, your host. In this section of the program, we're going to talk about the Lyric Opera. The Lyric Opera, who is one show down, two shows to go in their season. They have a special presentation coming up this Sunday, January the 11th at 4 o'clock p.m. at the historic Folly Theater in Kansas City. It's a special performance with tenor Vincent Cole. Also, and he has some guest artists with him coming up on the show as well. And also with us today, Deborah Sandler, the general director and CEO of the Lyric Opera in Kansas City. As I often say on the show, I like to go right to the top, you know, talk to the people in charge and have them on the program. But welcome to the show. It's always nice to talk to the people from the Lyric Opera. Mr. Cole, Mr. Vincent Cole, he is the guest artist for this special presentation. He began his training at UMKC and is currently a member of the faculty of the UMKC Conservatory of Music. He has won the MET, the Metropolitan Opera Audition Competition, and the WGN Competition, was awarded the Rockefeller Foundation and National Opera Institution grants. He has had roles with the Lyric Opera here in town, but the Metropolitan Opera of New York, the San Francisco Opera, Opera Nationale de Paris, the Paris Opera Bastille, the Paris Opera Comique, if I'm saying that right, the Chicago Lyric, Berlin, Vienna, the Salzburg Festival, Seattle, Houston, Santa Fe, St. Louis, and somehow through all that traveling, he ended up right back here in Kansas City. So nice to have you back.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
Look forward to seeing you this coming Sunday afternoon. Deborah Sandler is with us as well. She is the general director and CEO of the Lyric Opera. She comes from the Philadelphia area. She is in administration. She was a singer first. Maybe she'll tell us a little bit about that. She has worked in Kentucky with the Opera Festival in New Jersey. She studied math as well as music. And I suppose in her job as CEO, both of those probably come into play as well. Often it's nice, of course, to have you with us as well, Ms. Sandler.
Thank you very much, Michael. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
The Lyric has a regular season. They also have special presentations. Now, is this presentation part of the fundraising efforts for the Lyric Opera?
Well, we look at what we're doing all the time, and traditionally we have done four main stage productions on the stage of the Muriel Kaufman Theater at the Kaufman Performing Arts Center, and we have begun a program of added activities, and one of the things that we are doing this year, this is the second of such activities, but this is a benefit concert to honor our local legend, whose reputation is way beyond the local, as you have just shared with your listeners. We wanted to honor Vincent Cole. So this will be a benefit performance. It's called Vincent Cole and Friends, and there will be three other artists joining him on what I'm sure promises to be an exhilarating and inspirational concert recital.
Sounds like it will be. Christine Brewer is one of the people.
Yes, she's a soprano that I've worked with many times in concerts and in opera excerpts. Denny Belcher, who's local, went to school at William Jewell. And has sung with the Lyric on several occasions and other opera companies throughout the world. And then a very young mezzo-soprano from San Francisco, Zanda Svede, who was from Latvia. And I heard her sing last summer in San Francisco and immediately thought that she would be a wonderful addition for kind of an introduction, because she's a very, very, very talented young woman.
Now, both Christine and Daniel are Grammy Award winners. You've worked with both of them previously?
Funnily enough, Danny and I are good friends. We've never worked together. Christine and I have worked together. And so, one of us kind of proposed to me, Vincent Cole and Friends. So it was like, okay, I have to find friends.
Oh, I'm sure you have no problems there.
He would have no problems on that count, trust me.
I suppose the thing that would be the most important in something like that would be finding an opening in their schedule.
Yeah, there were people that were asked to do certain things and they really wanted to do it, and one was ready to come and then was being given an award that night. So she had to withdraw, and so we just kept going down the list.
But I think it is a great testament to Vincent, the number of people that we spoke to that wanted to participate and were unable to by virtue of their being in another country. For example, Joyce DiDonato said, I would have loved to have come, but I'm in Spain. And there are many, many other very well-known singers who would have loved to have come, principally to honor Vincent. So we were very excited about that.
In all your travel, singing around the world, is there one place, Paris here and others, is there any one place that you were the most impressed by? It said in your biography that you specialized in the French performances.
Yeah. I did a lot of things in France, a lot of things in Paris. If there was one place that I adored being, I would say that it would have to be, I did 8 seasons at the Sydney Opera House for the Opera Company, Opera Australia, And I really enjoyed being in Sydney. That was always a joy to go back there every year.
We see pictures of that, the Sydney Opera House on television, with the impressive, the way it goes up into the sky. Does that help acoustically, having the ceiling go up like that? It does not.
Unfortunately, you know, it's a very, very long, complicated story about the whole building of the Sydney Opera House and how it all started and how it deteriorated and then came back and everything. But unfortunately, the insides of the opera house and the concert hall were not what the original architect wanted. And so the opera house is the smaller of the two halls, and originally it was supposed to be the larger of the two halls. And so the acoustics in the opera house are not as great, but it's so small, it makes it, it's absolutely fine to sing in. The big problem for them is that the orchestra pit was built to be a musical theater orchestra pit, because that's what it was going to be. The theater for drama and musical theater. And so they've had to build a pit underneath the stage. So it's a problem more for them, although it's a very easy house to sing in, like I said, because it is such a small house. But it's very impressive when you first arrive and you're taken there and you see it and you go, oh my God. Yeah, it's very beautiful.
Yeah,
I guess.
I guess then that you were impressed with the people there and the audiences?
The people, the audiences. My first opera there was Don Jose, and when I did the last performance, it felt like I was leaving home, as I left and the last performance was, I felt very, very, very much at home. So that's why I was very happy to go back for those 8 years.
So you pretty much lived there?
Well, it was, you'd go back. I was always a guest in every opera house I sing at. So I was would go for, they do a lot of performances of one opera, sometimes 18.
Oh, wow.
So I would go back and would be there for anywhere from 3 to 6 months for 8 years. So it was, I lived there in a sort of way, and I have very, very, very close ties there, and very, very, very good friends that I talk to on almost on a weekly basis there.
Yeah, as I said, you're known for your interpretation of French repertoire. Was that something that was planned, or did it just kind of evolve into something like that?
It evolved because I hated French when I was a student in school. It was my worst language.
That's the higher power getting even with you.
It was my worst language. I was always intimidated by it. I think I was more intimidated by it. I mean, it was much easier to look at Italian and you can read that. Much easier to look at German and you could read that. You could look at French and you would see a word and you would say, I have no idea how that's pronounced. Because it's not pronounced the way it's written. So that was an intimidation. But then I just by happenstance was invited to sing the 100th anniversary of the first performance of Manon at the Opéra Comique. And so I started working on it and it felt very, very, very natural. And I found wonderful coaches in Paris that were great at teaching Americans how to sing French. And so that was kind of the beginning, and then it just kept snowballing. And then I found that the music fit my voice. I loved the way that it would go up and down and all the different things that I could do with the music. And so that was how it all started.
Are the audiences different in, say, Paris, Vienna, Berlin, Salzburg? Are they different from the American places?
Yes, to an extent. I mean, in Paris, at La Scala, in Vienna, they're very demonstrative.
Really?
If they like you, they really like you. If they don't, they have no qualms in letting you know that they're not pleased that night.
See, I would never think of booing an opera singer.
Oh, yes. I mean, one of the funny stories happened to me, but was at the Paris Opera. I was doing Le Comte Hoffmann, and we had one day between the general rehearsal and the premiere. And so I told the administration, I said, I would like to sing the pre-general rehearsal, to sing that full out and then mark most of the general because it's only one day and it's my very first Hoffman ever, which was crazy to do at the Paris Opera and to do your first Hoffman. And so they said, fine. I said, but you must make an announcement to it was an invited audience of orchestra members, families, and things like that. And then they said, fine, we will. Well, they made a very general announcement, like some people might sing here or there and some, you know. And of course, I marked everything. And you know, but you could still hear, but they were not pleased at the end. And so, but luckily I had a wonderful colleague and opera singer who was in the performance, which I didn't know, which was Régine Crespin, a very famous opera singer. And she came back and she just kind of said, these French people are so stupid. She said, your marking is better than most of their singing. So, so that made me feel good. And so then the performance, you know, 2 days later went, you know, very, very well with the general public. And, you know, so I was very happy.
Well, my thinking was that the French audience might be a little more critical than anywhere else.
No, I'm not any more critical than La Scala. La Scala in the middle of an aria can do things. Luckily, knock on wood, never happened. So
I've heard some of the performers say on national television interviews, they say, oh, the critics of the Metropolitan Opera in New York, the hardest critics in the world.
I've never experienced that in my, I mean, as an attendee and as a performer, I would say that they're probably one of the most generous audiences and forgiving and understanding. They will say, okay, it's not their greatest night, but, you know, it still was very, very good. So, they're forgiving, not a forgiving audience that they're just going to accept anything, but they understand.
Well, when you sing at the Met, you might be on national radio. You might be in one of these performances that are in theaters around the country. They're at one of the theaters here.
Sure. Oh, yeah. No, but they don't, you know, they're not vocally demonstrating as, I mean, you know, they bravo and they scream and they shout if they like something, but they're not, you know, they have the courtesy of, like, if they're not as pleased, they just applaud a little less. And so it's a little bit quieter.
Polite yet soft.
Yes.
We're speaking with Vincent Cole, the guest artist, and Deborah Sandler, the general director and CEO of the Lyric Opera here in Kansas City. They have a special performance coming up this Sunday, January the 11th at 4 o'clock p.m. in the Historic Folly Theater in downtown Kansas City. For more information on this, you can go online to their website, kcopera.org, or you may call their number 816-471-7344. The Historic Folly Theater is located at 300 West 12th Street, downtown Kansas City, essentially the corner of 12th and Broadway. You can see the Historic Folly Theater from there. That's probably a smaller house, Mr. Cole, than you're used to singing in.
Oh, when you do recitals in all different size houses. Especially recitals in Cleveland, there's a beautiful a hall called Mixon Recital Hall, which has only 500 seats, which is one of the most perfect places to sing. And the funny thing is that regarding the Folly, before the Folly was renovated, I won't tell many years ago, but I was asked to do a concert there with the Kansas City Philharmonic at that time with Maurice Perez, and there were no seats. There were benches.
Oh, my.
There were stools. And this was run Joan Dillon. It was kind of a kickoff for the start of the renovation of it. And a friend of mine was there, and one of my encores was the aria Una Furtiva Lagrima from Le Désir d'Amore. And it started to rain. And, I mean, this roof of the Folly had holes in it. And so this rain was coming through, and a friend turned to another friend and said, he's making the heavens cry. And so, which, you know, it's very, you know, it is what it is.
Yeah, that was a witty thing to say.
Yeah, but so I kind of was, I think, probably one of the first people to actually sing on the stage. I mean, there were lots of vaudeville people before me, of course.
Oh, of course.
But, the beginning of the renovation.
Have you sung there since then?
I haven't sung there since then. I've come with the Harriman Jewel series 4 times, but I did them one recital down in Gano, and then the rest of the recitals I did at the music hall.
Yes.
So.
Yes. Well, thank you for being here on the show. I suppose I should ask about your friends that are on the show, Christina Brewer, Daniel Belcher. We spoke a little bit about those. And the other lady, Zanda Svedi.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
Got them ready for the program. Did you divide up the program? Like, I'm going to do this number, you should do this number. Or do they pick?
Well, I wanted to make the concert because Deb, when she approached me about doing this, and, you know, it's the Vincent Golden Friends, I won't tell you what I said to her. And, and I said, okay.
Eventually, yes.
Yes.
What he said.
I said, yes. But, you know, when I approached these, my friends about singing, I said, choose things that you want to sing. I said, I don't want it to be an all operatic program. I said, I'd like it to be a recital program and an opera mixed together. And I said, choose what you enjoy singing. I said, nothing should be, oh, this is drudgery to sing this. This is a lot of work. I said, just have fun. And so that's what I think we've all chosen, a group of songs that we'll sing individually, which will be a hodgepodge, so to speak, when you look at the program. But it's things that we all enjoy doing. And then the duets, I said, what duet would you like to do with me? And we chose duets, I think, that will work and I think are fun. And well, except for Caught a Man, which is not so fun.
Well, some numbers are more difficult than others.
I get to kill her, so that's why it's not fun. But everything else is, you know, it has a certain, it's a concert of, in a recital music of enjoyment.
This will happen again Sunday, January the 11th, 4 o'clock p.m., the Folly Theater. The number to call, 816-471-7344. Any questions you would have? You can also go on their impressive website, kcopera.org, and learn about this performance, some biographies of the talent involved, and also the rest of the season for the opera. Deborah Sandler, the general director and CEO, is with us. The studies of math you had along with music, does that help you in your job at all? Juggling figures. I would think that would go pretty good together.
Because I have a very dual nature of my job. The term general director is well understood within the opera industry, but less well understood outside of the opera industry. And usually the person who is the general director, not usually, but the general director, is responsible both for the administrative and the overall artistic output of the company. So it's sometimes daunting because one side of my brain frequently fights with the other side of the brain. I want to do this. No, you can't afford it. Oh, but it would be great to do this. Listen, we can't do it this year. So it's sort of a, you know, strange existence to have those both sides of your brains engaged. But I think so because I have a innate desire and propensity to organization and order. And opera can be a very chaotic undertaking. What people don't realize is how far out the planning is with opera. And to do opera well, we can't turn anything around on a dime. Mm-hmm. For example, when a fiscal year starts, our expenses have already been accounted for the following year and sometimes even the year after. So you need something like a 3-year planning window to put these operas together and put the product together on stage. I mean, even casting takes a lot of advanced thought and planning if you want to get the people that you want on your stage. You can't, not something you can do 6 or 8 weeks in advance. It's got to be done a year in advance, at least at a minimum. And most of the really fine companies are casting 3 years in advance.
Oh, yeah. I would imagine so. You're probably not ready to announce, and I won't ask that, but you probably know what next year and maybe part of the year after
Absolutely.
That will be.
Absolutely. We have both of those in hand. One of the reasons that we're doing this benefit, it is a benefit for Lyric Opera, but we are very intentionally honoring Vincent Cole, who was one of the foremost international operatic tenors in the world. And we wanted to honor him as a citizen of Kansas City because I don't think he has received that honor sufficiently heretofore. One of the fun things about the program is that the different artists on the program are all at slightly different points in their careers. And together, they will create a wonderful, moving production. So the youngest member of our group is Zanda Zvedi, the Latvian soprano, who is now an Adler Fellow, a very prestigious award, at the San Francisco Opera in their training program. And I will say no more except to say that we will be hearing her on our main stage next year.
Uh-huh.
So this will be a preview of what's to come. Danny Belcher, who no longer lives in Kansas City but was from Kansas City, is probably one of the foremost proponents of contemporary music now. You find a composer who's working on a new piece, and Danny is at the heart of it. He is one of the most profound singing actors in our business, and he has appeared on all of the major stages. So he's a very fine artist. Christine Brewer, who is from St. Louis, our state, just across the end, is so well recognized as a wonderful interpreter, and we are really pleased to bring this all together to honor Vincent. So, yes, that is what is happening on January 11th, and then we have the remainder of our season. Good times.
Yeah, well, Silent Night is scheduled to open on February the 21st.
That's right. Silent Night is a very interesting piece. Silent Night was premiered internationally at the Minnesota Opera in 2011 and went on to win the Pulitzer Prize. It was written by Kevin Putz, and the librettist is Mark Campbell, and both of them are considered to be, if not the foremost, among the foremost of composer-librettist teams in the country. Silent Night was such a success that it has gone on to have five other performances, that is, new productions, not new productions, but performances throughout the country since 2011. That is a very quick record of performance. Usually new works take a certain amount of time to incubate and catch on, but it has been performed five times. We are the fifth, and it has just received its second new production in October at the very prestigious Wexford Festival. We are very proud to be doing it as part of the commemoration of the World War I centennial. Mm-hmm. We have been doing a lot of works, a lot of programming in collaboration with our National World War I Museum here. They have been very supportive. I mentioned earlier a program that we had done. I said this is the second added-on program. The first was a World War I cabaret at the World War I Museum. So we will be doing Silent Night. The evening before, on February 20th, we will be doing a panel at the Kauffman Center with the composer, with the librettist, and with well-known author Stanley Weintraub, who wrote the book Silent Night, which is based on the Christmas truce, which is what this opera is about. It's got five different languages in it, representing the different camps of soldiers. You know, just over Christmas, you may have seen so many postings in social media, and I know the Wall Street Journal had an article, and there are other publications that have talked about the Christmas truce and how unusual it was. And the idea is, if we really know our brothers, if we talk to them and consider them as human beings, it will be impossible to make war. And so there is a pacifist and a humanitarian aspect to this opera. The music is absolutely beautiful. Some people hear the term contemporary opera and they get scared. This is romantic. Kevin Putz is a fabulous, fabulous composer. So we are very proud to put that on the stage. And then moving on to the end of the season, we end with very traditional fare, and we end with Puccini's Tosca. And that is bound to hit everyone's sweet spot.
Oh, sure.
And that, yeah, that opens on...
I have April 18th.
Yeah, April 18th. You are right, Michael, as always. Thanks for sharing that.
No, not as always. Don't put the pressure on. Yeah. She mentioned several languages. Opera is often sung in Italian.
Oh, yeah.
Did you have to learn French, for instance?
I learned French. I learned Italian. I studied Italian when I was a student. German. I've sung in Russian, Hungarian, Czech, Portuguese.
You must have a great ear.
Well, some of the languages, you know, I mean, like Czech, I learned by, you know, having a wonderful Czech coach say it over and over. Once you're in the midst of a career, you don't have years to sit and study.
Of course.
And so you kind of learn it by rote, but you know, you do know exactly what every word means so that you can give the right inflection.
Yeah, as I've told singers before, I say often you don't need to know, as the audience, you don't need to know the language to understand, because the actors are acting as they're singing. Hopefully. Some of the finest actors I've seen have been in an opera.
Yeah, hopefully that comes across, that we do know what we're saying and that we're conveying and, you know, giving the correct impression. Sometimes you run up against stage director who wants you to do the opposite, and you go, but it doesn't mean that. So you have problems there, but you know, you work it out. But yes. I love words along with the music, and they fit.
Everything seems to be a collaborative process, and this is no different.
Yeah,
when you're standing in a big hall, I know the Kauffman isn't the biggest in the world, but and without mic, usually you project to that big hall. What goes through your mind at a moment like that?
Well, that's the training of an opera singer, you know, which is very different from almost every other singer that pursues a career. I mean, our job is to learn how to allow our voices to resonate so that it can reach, you know, a place like the Metropolitan Opera or Verona, which has no microphones, and it's 25,000 people, you know, an outdoor arena. So, you know, you have, and this is, that's our job. And hopefully you learn to do it well and be successful with it.
Well, thank you very much for being with us. The show, again, comes up this Sunday, January the 11th, 4 o'clock p.m., the Folly Theater. Our guest, Vincent Cole, will be there. He is the guest artist for this presentation. And with him, he's going to bring along Christina Brewer and Daniel Belcher, and they will all sing some of their favorites. As Vincent said in the show, which will kick off at 4 o'clock p.m. For more information, you may call, and I have the number down here. I've given it twice now, 816-471-7344, or online. Much more extensive information can be gotten online at kcopera.org. The Historic Folly Theater is in downtown Kansas City, 300 West 12th Street, essentially the corner of 12th and Broadway. At least from Broadway, you could see off to your... to the east, to either your right or your left, depending on which direction you're coming from. You can see the Historic Folly Theater down there. If you've never been there before, it's an interesting place to visit. The roof no longer leaks, of course. In fact, all the little intricate artwork, it's really impressive.
Yeah, it's very beautiful.
To watch.
It's very beautiful.
Thank you so much for being with us. Vincent Cole, guest artist, Deborah Sandler, the general director and CEO from the Lyric Opera of Kansas City, with their special presentation coming up this Sunday, January the 11th at 4 o'clock p.m. at the Folly Theater. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Michael.
The Jazz Insider is next. Great jazz. Jazz from 1 to 3. The blues from 3 to 6. Right here on your community radio station, 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City's community radio. So until next we meet, ladies and gentlemen, at that cross in the road, I'm Michael Hoag. We'll see you next time.